my name is Kjell Erik Øye, and I've actually been working with gay and lesbian issues from two different points of view, I think, or from two different positions. First, I was for 4 years the leader or the president of the National Lesbian and Gay Task Force in Norway. And I ran that organization for 4 years, and that was a period where we worked a lot with legislation issues. Secondly, I've had twice positions in the Norwegian government, both times in ministries that have actually dealt with or and been responsible for these issues. The first time I was the political advisor to the minister, and the second time, this previous, or the government we have now, I was the deputy minister in that ministry. And then we were the ministry that were responsible for all the gay and lesbian issues, actually.
What was your role in the organization that you ran for a few years, and what were those years in particular?
I have to think when it was. It was from 87 to 91, and then I was the president, the leader of the organization. It was the one we actually had two national gay and lesbian organizations at the time, one big one that I was in charge of, and then a smaller, more informal networking organization. They merged into one organization a couple of years later. The big issue while I was the leader was, it was actually two issues. It was, of course, HIV/AIDS. That was a major issue within the gay and lesbian community at the time, and still is, of course. And secondly, we worked with a legislation for gay and lesbian couples. So when I resigned in 91, I continued working with that issue as a part of a group called the Partnership Group. That was a group of gay and lesbian activists appointed by the organizations to actually coordinate and work with that issue. So we did a lot of lobbying towards the ministries, towards the parliament, and we actually managed to be the second country in the world that got such a law in 1993. The partnership law was completely similar to the marriage law, except for two things. We didn't get the right to adopt, and secondly, we weren't allowed to marry in the church. Besides from that, it actually said that the same rights and the same obligations that goes for straight people that are married also go for gay and lesbians that live in partnership.
When you arrive at the organization, what is the state of affairs at the moment? How do you find the issues at stake, and what's the kind of platform that you use?
It has been a long political debate within the gay and lesbian organization about legislations, and the organization didn't actually agree with themselves. There was a strong part of the organization that was against everything that could actually look like gay and lesbian marriage. Because they said that marriage is a straight thing that depresses women, and we should fight for a society where people are individuals, and that you should have individual rights. But at the same time, the gay and lesbian movement said that we would like a law that could actually regulate the partnership within a same-sex couple. And the question I and more people started to ask was, so what's going to be in that law and what's going to be left out? Can you give us any examples of things within the marriage law that we don't want? And people couldn't do that. It was more of a rhetorical question, I think, because people hadn't actually looked into the law and didn't actually know much about the marriage law as a legal law.
Can you describe the law to me precisely?
Well, the law is the same as you have in your countries and everywhere. It's the marriage law is a law that actually regulates the partnership, the couple, but it also regulates the relationship between the couple and the society. when it comes to inheritance, when it comes to tax, when it comes to being financial, economically responsible for each other, allowed to marry people from other countries, you know, all those rights. And to me, it was obvious that we can't just take a part of it. We have to take everything or nothing. It doesn't make sense to make one law for straight people and one law for gay people. Our opponents, both without and within the movement, said that the big difference is that we don't raise kids. Well, first, it isn't always true. A lot of gay and lesbian couples actually raise kids these days. And secondly, the marriage law doesn't actually regulate the relationship between the parents and the kids. There are other laws that regulate that. And we became kind of good. We had a lawyer within the group. She was very good at this. And most of us actually became very good also on those legislation issues, because it was a political issue, but it was also a legal issue. And we knew the arguments on both levels, I think.
The organization is or was state-funded, or was a private organization?
It was a private organization. It was an NGO with members. We didn't get much money from the government at that point. Actually, quite a little, I think. I don't remember the amount, but that was the years where the government actually also started to give us fundings. It happens approximately at the same time. Because as in other Western European and in America, United States and Canada, we got a lot of attention because of HIV/AIDS. So it was a lot of discussions about gay and lesbian issues in television, in media, and we had a lot of support from the mass media. So it was, in a way, a very challenging time because people died and we were scared and we dealt with that terrible disease. But secondly, we also felt that we were a movement that was actually pushing forward, very well organized. We were actually, when the law passed in 1993, the politicians in the parliament said that they have never ever met a group lobbying so strategic and so good as we did.
Can you describe the strategy to me? What is it exactly that you were doing?
What we did, we actually realized that people didn't know much what this was all about. And it was important for us to give people a lot of knowledge before they started to say what they actually meant about the law.
And by people you mean?
By politicians, mainly politicians. So what we actually did was, we didn't go to the mass. When we started this work, we didn't seek public attention, because we wanted to have meetings with a lot of important people first, tell them why we needed this law, why it couldn't be different than the marriage law. So, and I think the work went on for 1.5 years without any public notice on it. And then suddenly someone realized what was going on. But then we already had a lot of people in the parliament supporting us. And those who didn't actually say, yes, we want that law, at least said, this is something we have to discuss. Maybe it shouldn't be the law they ask for, but something has to happen. And then we continued. We had lists of parliament members. We had meetings with, I think we had meetings with more than 50% of the parliament members, which are 168 or something. Altogether, we had meetings with at least 10 ministers. We also realized something that people very seldom think of, and that is the fact that this is going to be discussed within the government, which means the other ministers are also going to have an opinion on that. So we had a Labour government at the moment, so we went and looked into who were the political advisors of those ministers. They came from, very often these are young people, and they very often come from the Labour youth movement. The Labour youth movement were some of the most important supporters of the work. So we went to them and said, give us a list of who should we meet that are political advisors of ministers. And they gave us that list. We went to meet them so that they could brief their ministers when it came up as a subject in the government. And we succeeded.
Were you fashioning this strategy on some other country's success in regards to this issue? Or were you inventing the wheel?
I think we invented most of it ourselves, because Denmark was the only country that actually had done this. and succeeded. We spoke with the Danes, and it helped us that the law actually passed in Denmark, because then it was obvious to everybody this is actually possible. Gave us a lot of energy, and of course it also gave us an argument. We said, look, Denmark has done it. Denmark hasn't disappeared from the surface of the earth. They are still there. People are living their lives.
This seems to be a critical moment. What was the background to achieve this moment? In other words, I understand homosexuality is decriminalized in 1972. What would you name? It's another pillar, and what happens in between?
I think there is one person that was the Secretary General of the gay and lesbian movement. She was also there when I became a leader. We had a conflict when she left, but we are friends now. But she was a very, very important person when it came to gay and lesbian rights in Norway. She was very, very well known in the mass media, in the public. She was very well spoken. She had no compromises. And she spoke very clearly about gay and lesbian rights. And she actually managed in 72, the law that prohibited homosexuality was removed. In 83, we got the law that made it illegal to discriminate gay and lesbian people. And then in 93, those 10 years intervals, we actually got the law that said it's not only okay to be homosexual, we would like to celebrate it, we'd like to protect it, we would like to support it. And she was a very important person. She was actually against the partnership law at the beginning.
In what grounds?
Well, she had two different approaches. She was, in the beginning, she was one of those that said that we don't want to copy the marriage law, the Marriage Act, because she said it's discriminating individuals, that it discriminates people that live alone. But then when we challenged her and said, well, what do you want? Because she was in favor of some kind of a legislation. I said, what do you want? What is your idea of a law? She couldn't give a good answer. Then she changed her mind, I think. And then her final argument against it, which I actually can understand, was that since they won't let us adapt, we shouldn't accept this law. We should have everything or nothing. I think that was the wrong strategy. I think it was a good strategy to leave the kids out at that moment, but it was important for us that they didn't say anywhere in the law or I don't know the English term, because in everything that is written before you actually propose a law, that the ministry says a lot about the reasons why they wanted them and so forth. They never said that gay and lesbian shouldn't raise kids. They just said that's another issue. And we worked very hard for that sentence to be very neutral.
So you wanted to introduce it slowly later, yeah. I suppose.
I remember when I've seen a television clip, an interview with me the night the law passed. And then I was asked, well, what's your next fight? Are you not going to fight for adoption rights? And I said, I don't know, but I'm not going to be a part of that fight, I said. Which I felt at that moment, I was tired, I had achieved what we had fought for, but I came back.
It would be interesting for me to understand why Scandinavian countries and Norway, Denmark first, Norway second, and later on Sweden, would be a fertile ground for this kind of legislation to take place in that way, as opposed to other countries Italy would be the last country to compare it to, but say Spain that came later on, or France that doesn't even have it. What in the political system does it have to do with the welfare state as like a political system? How do you take this?
I think there are several reasons for it. One is that we are a very well educated country. I think education is a key issue. People have knowledge. I think if people don't have knowledge, they have fear instead, or prejudice. That is one reason. Second reason is that we have had a very strong labor movement or left-wing governments in these countries for many years. And it hasn't been the conservatives in Norway or Sweden and Denmark that has pushed this forward. And the third reason, the church is not so strong here. They are strong, they do have influence, but they are not a very conservative church. at least not the whole church, and they are not a very influential political power in this country. I think those three reasons are the main reasons why the Scandinavian countries and the Netherlands are actually managed to achieve this.
I suppose it also has something to do with this foundational idea of equality among citizens of
society. Which I think is a social democratic left idea. So to me it fits with the fact that we have had so very strong left governments for many years that has fought for equality. To be honest, or to be fair against the conservatives, who I must also say that the conservative party here is not so conservative as the Republicans. They are more like the Democrats in the United States. They have been supporting a lot of gay and lesbian issues. They have never pushed it forward because every time they have been in the government, they have been with the Christian Democrats. That has, of course, always said no to those issues. But they have been supportive. They've had their Minister of Finance was an openly gay man. The major, not the major, but the one of the main politicians in Oslo, who is a very well-known conservative, is a gay man. So, and they did help us also now to actually get a lot of a huge majority, a vast majority within the parliament when we passed the Marriage Act 2 years ago.
And how did you relate to or converse with a more academic and kind of ideological gay and lesbian movement? In other words, how do you deal with queer studies, with the kind of birth of queer studies, the kind of opposition from the frictions that may bring between the official and the academic in this?
These issues have never been major issues in Norway. They have been debated within a small number of people that have been doing gay and lesbian studies. It has never been a political issue as such. It has been debated within the gay and lesbian community, never outside the gay and lesbian community. They tried to actually make a new platform for the gay and lesbian task force, I think five years ago, where they actually tried to introduce the queer thinking. But they failed.
Why do you think they failed?
Because I think deep down, it boils down to a debate about whether you are born homosexual or not. And I think that a lot of gay and lesbians in Norway feel that they are born gay and lesbian. I don't say that's the answer. Obviously, it's not the answer to everybody. But a lot of people feel that. And a lot of people say, and has used as an argument, that since I am the way I am, I can't help it, you have to support me. I think that's a terrible way of arguing. Whether you choose it, or you're born that way, or whatever reason you're gay and lesbian, that shouldn't be the reason why people should support you. People should support you because that's the way you want to live your life, and you don't harm anyone, and that's what you need to have a happy life. But the debate has come up. But it has never been a strong moment in Norway. Never. And it hasn't been, not even within the academic circles. I don't think this has really been the big issue. And maybe one of the reasons is that when they have discussed it, they have discussed it in a way that people feel is not linked to their lives. People don't understand this is some theoretical issue. And mm-hmm. Yeah. I've been in a couple of debates about it. I don't personally find that debate very interesting. I have to admit that. Not because I don't like intellectual or theoretical debates, because I think they can be very challenging. But they are in a way so far-fetched from people's lives.
Can you be precise exactly what do you refer?
If you ask gay and lesbian people, what are your concerns? Well, my concern is, I don't know how to be open at work. My concern is I don't have a lover. I'm lonely. My concern is I'm HIV positive. My concern is I'm a girl. I would very much like to have a baby. And the queer issue doesn't deal with those issues, I think. They don't deal with the everyday life of gays and lesbians. They deal with issues that are important for some gays and lesbians or bisexuals or people that doesn't want to define themselves. It is obvious that you can argue and say that homosexuality as a category has failed or is too rigid. Of course you can. And I can also tell myself that in a society where people didn't push me towards homosexuality, because in a way they did, because when you felt you had those feelings, it was obviously that you must be clear about them, you must fight for them, you must, and you didn't open for anything else. You were gay. I mean, for me, in my life, to say I think I'm gay or I think I might be gay now, but I might fall in love with a woman later on, was a catastrophe to say.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that was right. Maybe it would have happened, or maybe I could have been more open to girls.
Do you mean in terms of your career?
No. I mean in terms. No, definitely not. Okay. No, I mean in terms of my personal development, because okay. It was. When you are insecure and when you want to fight for someone, something, you need a platform to stand from, to fight from. And I think a lot of us felt that we needed a platform that gave us a clear identity. And the queer theory kind of made that identity unclear.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I suppose it's the same kind of clearness that you need as a movement politically in order to achieve things, right?
Exactly. I think that if we had introduced the queer theory as an argument in the debate, people wouldn't have understood what we talked about. We would have lost, I think.
What is the relationship that you see between the legislation that you have managed to accomplish in this country and the way that people actually live their lives? Do you find that this legislation has an effect on the way teenagers are open about their sexuality? Are people out of the closet? Do they feel that they are equal citizens in that regard, or is there a leap yet to be bridged?
Of course there is a leap to be bridged.
Can you explain that?
A lot of people still feel insecure. A lot of people are being bullied in schools. A lot of people feel uncertain about their sexuality, feel ashamed. But on the other hand, there are two good things about the legislation. One is that the government has said it's okay. It's not only okay, we support it. We think it's great that you find each other. And the other thing is that it's very, especially when you had the partnership law, now that actually has changed because now we have one law for everybody. But when we had the partnership law, everybody that got this formal schemes to fill out for any kind of reason, you had to say, are you married? Yes, no. Do you live in a partnership? Yes, no. So everybody had to kind of to see the word partnership, and everybody knew what that meant. Straight people, gay people, you were very, very visible. And I think that wasn't, of course, the main reason why we had the partnership law, but that was a very good thing about it. Suddenly, you saw it everywhere. And people talked about partnerships. People went to partnerships and celebrated their gay and lesbian friends that wanted to live together. But I don't think, and then this Marriage Act came, and now the partnership law is dead. It's gone. Which was obviously the right thing to do, I think. But now we are invisible again.
What do you mean?
Yeah, now we are married or not married. But it doesn't say whether you are married to a man or a woman. So the difference between gay and lesbian couples and straight couples that was so visible before is gone on those schemes, those formal schemes.
Yes.
I think that's a good thing in a way. But it, yeah.
Do you find that it's an issue politically, or?
No, it's an issue to me. I find it amusing, but it's also kind of, not sad, but it's kind of, I think that it had a side effect, the fact that it was so, that the partnership law was so, was different and made us so visible. A positive side effect that now it's gone. But it was a side effect. It wasn't the main reason for the law.
When you work on, when you are lobbying or conceiving this kind of law, and are you also conceiving a kind of educational program to go along with it and be taught in schools and yes. change the way that...
Norway has done a lot of things on those issues. When I was in the government now, I resigned in April, I was responsible for pushing forward a lot of things that should be done. Schools, healthcare. And we made a plan of action. It was the first plan of action from a government ever, I think, that stated on a lot of issues how we should deal with gay and lesbian issues and gay and lesbian discrimination and legislation. Because now the formal things are there, except for the church, but they come. They just need some time. But the formal things are there. It's the laws are equal for everybody. We can adopt. We are not allowed. They are not allowed to fire us in schools, but of course we still need to educate people to, first of all, have knowledge about homosexuality, how it is to be a homosexual, and secondly, to seek for homosexuals. I mean, ask the question that, because, as Karin Lützen, I think, has also said, there is a. There is a heterosexual assumption out there that everybody think you're heterosexual until you say something otherwise. And that continues, of course. I can feel it now. I work in the countries in the south. It's difficult sometimes to say that I'm gay. In Gambia, we were on vacation, me and my lover. The president just stated that gay people should be beheaded. Of course, in an atmosphere like that, it's not like, hello, I'm gay, I'm happy to be gay. You have to, you still have to adjust. I sometimes have to adjust, not because I'm not safe when I'm out there, but I know that the moment I tell my colleagues, let's say in Rwanda, that I'm gay, I don't know what kind of reaction I get. And I don't know if that's going to destroy the work I'm going to do there. And the work I'm going to do there is the most important thing. That's why I'm there. I think that's a difficult issue.
Is the work that you're going to do that related to these issues of sexuality?
No. I deal, well, of course, everything is, but it's not.
Directly.
I work with kids and development aid and children.
What comes next after the Marriage Act in terms of legislation and that kind of work?
Nothing. So I don't see anything in the legislation at the moment that should be changed.
Anything that should be added to it?
Of course, when it comes to foreign policy and it comes to who has a reason to seek for asylum in Norway, yes, maybe. There we still have a lot of things to do. But when it comes to the national legislation, I can see what that should be.
Could you list the challenges that you think are pressing at the moment for the gay and lesbian community, and also to extend the question?
Please eat.
Thank you.
It's for you too.
Do you think that because it seems like the G and the L are equal citizens in this country, is the T also so?
Very good question. I hear myself saying gay and lesbian all the time because that's mainly because it's so difficult to say all those words at the same time.
Right.
But of course, it's also a symbol of what's on my forehead. The T is somehow more different discussion in Norway than in many other countries. Because the transgender task force, the leader of them, she has chosen another path in a way.
Who is the leader?
Tone Marie Hansen. She is a close friend of mine. I think she's a very nice and very bright woman, but I think she is on the wrong path. I don't know. But she is talking, she is very much concerned about not talking so much about transgender, but talking about gender. She says, I'm a woman, I'm not a transgender person, I have changed, I'm a woman. And that's important for them. And there has been a debate within Norway because of that. So, because they don't agree to be linked to the gay and lesbian issues. Not because they are against or doesn't support or that we don't talk to each other. But they say that we are women and we are men and we would like to be seen as women and men, nothing in between.
It's not an issue of sexual orientation.
No, exactly. Exactly. It's more a biological issue. And because of that, they didn't want to be a part of the plan of action that we actually made for gay and lesbian and T's in the government. So they actually were left out because they wanted to be left out. But the transvestites, they are a part of it.
What is this plan of action that you have?
Well, the government, as I said, the government made a plan of action of how to deal with different issues when it comes to these communities. School, healthcare, criminal justice, hate crime, you know, all those issues. And then the T was a part of that plan. But the T, as it is defined in that plan, is mainly the transvestites, not the transgender population, because they didn't want to be a part of that plan. We had a lot of debate. I had many meetings with them about that. On the other hand, we were one of the first things we did in the government was actually to give them money to support their organization, because they had just got governmental funding from the health department, which made them very much a health issue. I disagreed in that. I said, they are our responsibility. This is a matter of equality and discrimination, and all those issues. So they were moved to our ministry and we gave them governmental grants to support their organization. It's a small organization, not many, and they probably won't be too many anyway, so they need support to actually establish an office. But they have chosen to be left out in a way.
Strategically, I suppose.
Yes. That's their choice. I mean, I shouldn't tell them what to do. I have said that to Tone Marie. I don't understand that choice. I think it's a wrong path. I think you're isolating yourself. But
well, it's a very common debate. However, I mean, in other words, it's because how it's like you're going to be embraced by a law that is not really defining what you are. And internationally, the debate is exactly this one, that it's an issue of gender identity and not of sexual orientation.
And I can understand that, but what differs them here is that they have made a decision. And I think the sad part about it is that it has created a gap between the gay and lesbian community and the transgender community. That isn't hostile or anything, but it's... we don't work together, and I think this is an issue of sexual orientation, and I think there are, maybe there, that's where I actually support some of the queer theory. I think there are so many people that are in between and that feel that they are part of this and a little bit part of this, and they shouldn't be forced to choose in a way.
What does that mean practically, that decision that was made by this woman or by them as an organization? Are they not supported by the law? Are they? Is there an anti-discrimination law that supports them?
They are not supported by any anti-discrimination law. No. There is another important debate going on in Norway, because we have a very fragmented anti-discrimination legislation in this country. That is actually an issue that is coming up now. Gays and lesbians are protected in some laws, ethnic minorities in others, disabled people in the third law. And it's very chaotic. So what the government has done, they have put down a group of people that are now looking into to see if we should have a legislation for everybody. Then, of course, the issue comes up. Should the legislation say we shouldn't discriminate gay and lesbian, ethnic minorities, disabled people, blah, 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 or should it just say nobody should be discriminated due to reason that has nothing to do with, let's say, housing or work or whatever. I think if we are going to make a legislation for everybody, it has to be a law like that. You can't mention everybody because there will be a new group. What if suddenly fat people are discriminated against or whatever. But then, of course, people will protest because they will feel invisible again. We have just made a law while I was in government for prohibited discrimination of disabled people in this country. Of course, they will be furious if this law is now withdrawn and replaced with a more general law,
mm-hmm.
even though it gives them the same legal protection, because it's also a matter of identity and visibility. So it's going to be a hard and difficult debate.
Let me break down some issues that are part of this plan. HIV/AIDS, can you talk to me about what
HIV/AIDS is a plan on its own.
Can you discuss this plan and how has it changed the narrative about it has changed since the AIDS crisis in the 80s to now?
I don't think I know enough about it.
Okay.
Because this was the responsibility of another ministry. I wasn't dealing very much with it. And I haven't been an AIDS activist since I was very young, and that's many, many years ago. But what I do know that is that one of the issues that is actually legislative issue is whether you should be punished if you, as an HIV positive, have sex with someone and don't tell them, especially if you infect them. That has been a major issue the last couple of years. And Norway has a very strong, and some people will say very hostile, repressive legislation on that issue. Because you can be punished, and you have been punished in Norway, if you have had sex, unprotected sex, anal intercourse or intercourse with a woman, and you have infected a person, and you haven't told them previously that you are HIV.
What is the punishment?
Up to 3 years in prison, I think. So it's strong, if you infect someone, yeah. So it's a very... I think that's a difficult issue, because I agree with those who say that it's everybody's responsibility. You have a responsibility to protect yourself. You have a responsibility not to infect others. I also agree with those that say that if you choose to punish a person that know he or she is HIV positive, and you don't punish a person that hasn't got tested but actually should know or should think that he is or she is, that's unfair. But on the other hand, and I am kind of alone in the gay and lesbian movement, I think, on the other hand, no, I just come off, I just remember another legislation that is important. I'll mm-hmm. talk about it afterwards. But it's like if I walk on red light, I shouldn't walk on red light. But if I do, and a car comes, it still should stop. Even if it's my responsibility not to go on green light. And we talk of these issues as if people are equal. I mean, if you are a young, scared kid going to a sauna, and you get fucked by a guy with a lot of resources, and the young kid is drunk, you are sober, you are HIV infected, you know you are HIV infected, but since the kid doesn't say anything, are you entitled to fuck him without protection? I don't think so. And if you don't think so, what should the reaction be if you are caught? That's the question.
It seems like it's an ethical issue.
It is an ethical, of course, everybody agrees it's an ethical issue. But people don't agree whether it should be punishable or not. And people aren't equal. People live different lives. People live different stages of their lives, and we should always support the weakest ones. And that's not all. Not always the HIV positive guy. But we talk as if it is, and I don't think that's the truth always. Of course, the other issue that comes up now is the issue of what you do with kids. Because now the lesbians are allowed to have artificial insemination in Norway, so a lesbian couple can get kids in Norway without involving any man. They can go to a clinic in Norway or in another country, and when they both agree, they get the birth certificate stating that they are equal mothers. They don't have to apply or anything, they are equal mothers. But when it comes to boys, you of course don't have that opportunity. And this question has actually come up now as a more important issue, because before people did like me and Trond has done, we have two boys with a lesbian girl. So we have been fathers for many years. My oldest son is 18. But lesbians don't do that anymore, because they don't have to. They don't have to bring a gay man into their relationship. They can go and get artificial insemination, and then they can come to you and say, would you like to be some kind of an uncle for this kid? And of course, that puts a lot of gay men in a position where they say, I want the kid, how can I get this kid? And what has happened in Norway is that quite a few young men, single or couples, come to the United States, California mainly, and got kids from a surrogate mother. In Norway, that's not accepted. In Norway, the law is stating that the woman that gives birth to the child is the child's mother. Which means that even if you have got an egg from another woman, implemented it in this woman, and she has given birth, she's the mother, not the woman with the egg, but the woman that gives birth to it. So what these men do is that they come home with a kid, and it says the mother is unknown, I'm the father. Of course, Norwegian legislation accepts that, you are the father. It's registered in Norway as your child. But then some men come home as a couple, and they say, and they have even got a certificate from the United States stating that they are their fathers. Then the Norwegian authorities said, no. There must be a mother somewhere. Where is she? Yeah, but she is a surrogate. Well, we need proof of that. That has created a lot of trouble. And now there is a debate within the gay and lesbian community whether Norwegian legislation should open for surrogacy or not. And it has divided, in a way, the gay and lesbian movement into two groups, where the boys say, we want the legislation to open for this. And the girl says, no, because this is to use an other person's body to achieve something that you want. And this debate is just slowly coming up. What everybody agrees upon, though, is that these men that comes home from abroad with those kids, these kids should have the right to the same legislation as other kids. Which means that if you're a single father, it's okay, we accept that. If you do have a boyfriend and you live with him, he can adopt the child. But then you need a paper from the mother saying, I accept that this child is adopted. And I don't claim the parent right for this child. And some of the gay men in Norway are furious about this. They say, why should we adopt our own child? This is my child. And then my answer is, well, what do you do if this woman changes her mind and comes to Norway and claims that child? Because if you adopt a child, you have to be absolutely certain that there is nobody else that can claim that child. And you can't be that if you just come home with a baby that you could not have gone anywhere. And because in Norway, the surrogate mother is the mother of the child. What if the other mother comes and says, I'm the mother, and I have a DNA test that can prove that?
Right.
Yeah. So we need legislation on this. It's a new area where it's kind of chaotic at the moment.
Hate crimes. Is it an issue in Norway?
Yes.
And what is the legislation to support it?
It was an issue a few years ago, or many years ago, I remember, when I was active. And nobody took it seriously. We had, in a period of 4 years, we had, I think, 8 or 9 gay men that were killed. And we had a lot of mass media about it, but nobody called it hate crime. It was hate crime. It was someone that had taken a boy home and he got angry and he killed him, or somebody that was knocked down in the park and killed. And a few years after, a black boy was killed. Then everybody here went marching with candles and cried. The whole nation was weeping. And to some of us, this was very offending. Not because they went, because a lot of us went on that march because of this kid, Benjamin. But this has had happened with gay men for many years. Nobody.
So people were marching because it was a racial issue.
It was a racial issue, not a gay issue. But nobody dared. I mean, it was very difficult to stand up then at that time and say, hey, why do you march for Benjamin when you didn't march for us? It was very difficult. So when this, and I have to say, this, the government that was the government in the previous period, it's the same government now, but I was a part of it from 2005 till 2009, is the most, and I think you will, I think everybody within the gay and lesbian community will agree on what I say, was the most progressive government for gay and lesbians ever. What we did within those 2 years, we raised the money given to the gay and lesbian issues from 3 million a year to 22 million a year. We got the legislation law. We made the plan of action. We started to deal with hate crime. I'll tell you about that. And the foreign minister said that gay and lesbian issues is a part of the human rights and will be a part of the dialogue with other countries when I'm abroad. All those issues were brought up within those 4 years. And I've never been handled this way before. So I think we were a very good government for the gay and lesbian community. When it came to hate crime, we spoke with the Minister of Justice. We had a dialogue with him. And we also had a strong political movement within the Labour Party. There is a guy called Håkon Høgli. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's now a parliament member. He's an open gay man, and he was leading the gay and lesbian group within the Social Democrat or Labour Party. He was very, very good at within those 4 years as well. He went to me and he pushed me, of course, but he also went to the Minister of Justice and said, what am I going to do with hate crime? So what they decided to do was, the first thing they did was to make it clear that it has to be registered as a hate crime, because they didn't have any data on it, because it was just an incident, or you had just been knocked down, or the fact that you were gay was not an issue. So that's the first thing they did. Then we went to Sweden, that had come further than us, with a group. We invited the gay and lesbian movement, and we went to Sweden to study and see what they had done. And then he changed the legislation so that it's going to be more punishable if it is a hate crime. And they have also given a lot of money to the gay and lesbian task force to find out how many people have experienced hate crime, because they didn't have any data on it, and how should we deal with it, and also to raise awareness within the police. And all these things is a part of this plan of action, actually. That is a cross-cutting plan through the ministries.
Before you do this, this kind of crime was just punishable under the anti-discrimination law?
No, it was punishable because it's punishable if you hit someone. But it wasn't more punishable if you hit a guy that was, because he was gay. Now it is. And of course then we have had this, which is a sad debate, but we have to go through it. Because we see that a lot of the guys that, and it's very often guys, that knock down lesbians and gay people are Muslims. And of course that brings up the issue, how do we deal with gay and lesbian questions within the Muslim communities, which is a difficult, very difficult thing.
What is the situation with non-Norwegians, with issues of
much worse.
Immigration within gay and lesbian community?
Much worse. I think we have just seen the top of the iceberg. This hasn't been an issue that really has been addressed until the last couple of years. Now there is a part of the gay and lesbian union that is actually addressing this. One of them actually asked me for a meeting the other day to see how they could lobby my former colleagues within the government about these issues. It is a matter of legislation. We had a terrible debate within the government that I hope is solved now about whether being gay is just a matter of holding hand in the street or more a political identical issue. And I was shocked of how little people that should know better knew and understood about this, because they said you can just go back to Iraq and you don't have to hold hand in the street, and that's not an issue of human rights, because women can't hold hands, straight couple can't hold hands in Iraq either. And then try to explain that it's much deeper than that, it goes beyond that. I think it's slowly changing, and people understand more and more, but within Norway, within the gay and lesbian community, there are very, very few open, for instance, it's not only a Muslim issue,
right.
It's a Jewish issue, it's a Hindu issue, it's a Christian issue, but they are not very, very open. They live in the closet, they hide themselves, they are scared, they do get education now, they do get contact information when they come to Norway if they tell that they are gay and lesbians. Of course, a lot of them don't. It's still used against them if they come back after 3 months and say, I didn't tell you I was gay. Okay, you didn't tell me when you come. That's new information. You should have told me, because no, I don't believe you. You just say this because you know that, all those issues.
That seems to cross over very difficult paths, the whole kind of huge issue of immigration in this country, and then
but it's not only a matter of immigration, because that is one important part of it, I agree, and I think we have to go through the legislation and see on maybe not the legislation but the way it's practiced again, because I've seen a few examples the last few weeks in the media that scares me, if they are true, I don't know. But I don't know anymore. Before I could find out whether it was true. No, I can't, because I'm part of the government. But the other side of it is how we as a community deal with gay and lesbian Muslims or gay and lesbian from other ethnic origin than Norway. And also how the religious groups deal with homosexuality. And that is more difficult for a Muslim or a young Jew than it is for a Christian, because for Jews, at least some of them, and for most Muslims, their whole social life is so linked to the religion. That isn't so in most Norwegians' lives. So they can more easily live side by side with a grandmother that doesn't accept them because she believes in God or whatever. But in this Muslim communities, it's not so. But I think the only answer to that is openness. The only answer. Secretary General of the Islamic Council of Norway, he's a very moderate, very nice guy. I'm friends with him on Facebook. I met him on several meetings. I can chat with him, talk with him. I still don't know what he deep down feel about me.
About you or sexuality?
About politics? My sexuality. He knows I'm gay because I'm publicly known gay, but I don't know, and I would like to ask him one day, how will you react if one of your twin daughters is going to tell you she's a lesbian? I don't know what his answer
is. That only happens to the neighbors.
It only happens to the neighbors. I don't know. And one guy that was a social democrat, he is originally from Pakistan, he came to Norway when he was 5. He has been a part of the social democratic movement for many, many years. And me and the minister and him had a meeting, and she asked him, and he was very much against gay and lesbian relationships. and it became a public thing because he was also a member of this Islamic Council. And then she said, but what about Chileric? You've known him for many years. Would you invite him for lunch? And he said, no, I might not. And to me, that was a shock. This was a guy that is raised in Norway.
Mm.
He has been there since he was five. He has been working in the same communities as I am, the same political movement we have been. And he has always been nice to me when I met him on political meetings. Still, he thinks it's wrong.
Everything has been accomplished, and you're in very good ground, it seems, in comparison to
many other countries,
most countries in particular. But is there a possibility that these things could be reverted were there to be a change in government?
Yes.
Is there an opposition?
There is an opposition. At least two of the political parties on the opposition will actually reverse the marriage law. I don't think they will manage to do that because they won't get majority in the parliament to do so because the conservatives won't change it. But I think the worst thing we can do is to lean back and say, the war is over, we have won, no, it's good. On the other hand, we can't ask young gays and lesbians to keep fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting. They have to. They need to also lean back and say, I live in a society where I'm accepted, I can relax, I can hold hands, I can achieve a very, very good life. There are so many examples of gays and lesbians that live brilliant lives, very open. So I have to do both. But we have to be aware that even to compare Norway with Berlin before the war is a very... I don't think we should do that, but we have to remember in Berlin before the war, it was a marvelous, great gay lesbian movement. They were happy. Look what happened. I don't say this is going to happen here. I just say that we have to be aware. There are people out there who doesn't like us, doesn't like think that what we are doing is actually ruining this country. It's perverted. It's not something that should be supported. Mm. So you shouldn't take support for granted.
How do you see... from a distance, the debate in the United States, which is so kind of atrocious and schizophrenic at the moment.
I love United States. I think United States is a great country. I have a lot of American relatives. I've been to United States many times. My aunt is married to American. Trond's brother is married to American. But America is a very, very moralistic, conservative country when it comes to these issues. And it's not only on these issues, but on many other issues. But I see two things now. One that makes me happy, and one thing that scares me. You have, in spite of everything, got a president that actually speaks openly about these issues. That's a very, very good thing. But on the other hand, we see what's happening now. The conservatives are gathering, are fighting, organizing themselves, the conservative Christians in your country. And they scare me. They are maybe one of the most powerful and one of the most scary political movements in the western part of the world.